This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That means we ask for reporters in Northwest Indiana media to join us to talk about the stories they've put out in print and online. And we have with us first, we have Dan Carton, who's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And he covers a number of other stories, too, not necessarily related directly to politics, but in this case, some of them seem to, I know. Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start out first with the latest news coming from the community of Portage about the former clerk treasurer. He's going to be a very busy guy in whatever profession he chooses now, because I know he's, at least for temporarily, he's not going to be able to practice law.
Yeah, Chris Stidham is a former clerk treasurer of Portage. He ran for mayor unsuccessfully in 2019. But after that, he was convicted in court of a felony charge of conflict of interest for steering some city funds to his spouse's, his partner's businesses. He's convicted under Indiana law. If you are convicted of a felony, or not necessarily Indiana law, I believe it's Supreme Court rules, but in any case, the Indiana Supreme Court took action to suspend his law license on an interim basis while it further considers, his case and could potentially, suspend it for a term of years or could disbar him, not allow him to practice law at all in the future. So right now he's definitely not allowed to practice law, and what happens to him in the future will be determined by the Supreme Court in the months and years ahead.
I suppose it will be up to the Indiana Supreme Court to decide if the suspension of a year would be long enough. That is, that's the time he has to spend on supervised probation instead of going to jail for the charge. So he may just be out of having to work as an attorney for a year, and I guess we'll have to see whether he's able to practice law longer than that, I imagine.
Yeah, and this happens quite a bit. Anytime a lawyer is convicted of a crime, particularly a felony, one of the things lawyers take an oath to uphold is, they agree to follow the law and, ensure respect for the law through their profession. In this case, obviously being convicted of a felony, having it happen in connection with a public office or a position of trust, that's a couple of strikes against him right there. So that's why the Supreme Court took this action. I mean, they do the same thing for lawyers, convicted of DUI and other crimes like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose, because all the financial matters that the attorneys have to handle is part of their practice. They've got to be extra careful. Things can happen, and they can slip, and if they get caught, I suppose that's where the Indiana Supreme Court can step in and have some punishment if there is anything to hand out, I suppose.
Right. And, being a lawyer is a state-licensed occupation, so there's rules you have to follow, and particularly with, speaking for or representing the law in some way, the Supreme Court expects those people to, especially, to follow the law.
Mm-hmm. One of the other story areas that you cover, of course, the Indiana General Assembly, and we'll talk in a little more detail, at least on one particular facet of the legislature coming up, but you also get to cover state government and write stories about it. In fact, one of the other stories you put out recently in print online talks about the latest information from the Indiana State Budget Agency on how the state revenues, the tax revenues, that is, are coming in. Will you fill us in on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Every month, the State Budget Agency puts out a report of, the money that was taken in from taxes in the previous month. And in July, Indiana was way above expectations. The State Budget Agency and the General Assembly and some other people put together a revenue forecast in April that they used to craft the new two-year state budget. And it's based, and Indiana's required to have a balanced budget, so they come up with these estimates for how much money the state is predicted to take in and all the different tax revenues, sales tax, income tax, corporate income tax, casino revenue, cigarette tax. And as the year goes along, the governor and others in state government sort of adjust spending to make sure that the state isn't spending more money than it's taking in. In this case, in July, the state actually beat its target by $65 million, or 5%, which is a pretty big miss, but a miss on the positive side because this is extra money coming into the state. So, I don't think anybody was too upset to miss the target by 5% on the upside.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something that the auditors don't seem to mind too much is that if we bring in more money, they won't be upset if you did happen to miss the target, especially if it's, as you say, if it's on the plus side, to be sure. This will have an impact, I guess, on all of us in a way, because at least we'll get some kind of tax credit down the road, won't we?
Yeah, this is actually the July revenue doesn't affect this, but Indiana came in way above predictions in April, May, and June by $1.2 billion. So that ended up growing the state's budget reserve beyond a certain threshold in state law. So next year, everybody who files an income tax return is going to get, they're predicting about $175 income tax credit against the taxes you owe to, in effect, return that excess money to the taxpayers. Basically, if you owe taxes, you probably won't. Once you get this credit applied, or if you were going to get a refund, you're going to get an even bigger refund. So that's how that money gets sent back to Hoosier taxpayers.
I also noticed in your story as well, talking about the revenue data from Indianapolis, that you also mentioned too about the impact that the federal increases of revenue coming in through the action of the president and Democratic-controlled Congress will have on Indiana. But in turn, you also mentioned some of the reaction to the two senators who were not necessarily pleased with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. So Indiana has this huge revenue surplus, budget reserve, and a lot of it is attributable to these Democratic policies coming out of Washington. Turns out if you send everybody a $1,400 check, most people are going to take that and spend it in stores, which generates sales tax revenue. Stores need to hire more people to accommodate all these customers. That generates more income tax revenue. So this Republican-controlled state of Indiana is ending up with a ton of cash in the bank because of these Democratic policies from Washington that, ironically, all the Republicans representing Indiana in Washington are voting against. So there's these great times happening for the Republican governor and the Republican General Assembly. They don't even know how to spend all this money. But the Republicans representing Indiana in Congress are saying, oh, no, this should not even be happening. So it's sort of an interesting split between in-state Republicans and D.C. Republicans.
I know that in particular, although it's not in this particular story, but you've had some other comments as well, too, that's been in print and online following through on that as well, especially comments that Senator Todd Young has made about the measure. We had this about face, and you had a story about that, making an about face concerning the vote on the bill for putting the plan into effect. And you mentioned, too, also about the reaction that Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr., who has not officially announced, or I guess he can't yet announce that he is going to run for Congress, but he's certainly very, very, very interested in the job in Washington. And the mayor didn't have much good to say about Senator Young about that, too.
Right. So the state revenue all stems from the American Jobs Plan, which passed in March, that Senator Young, Senator Braun, all the Republicans representing Indiana in Congress voted against, but it still managed to pass because Democrats control both chambers of Congress and the White House. What's under consideration now is this massive infrastructure plan that Senator Todd Young was a part of negotiating. He was part of this group of 20 senators, bipartisan senators, Republicans and Democrats, working together to try and come up with a plan to increase federal funding for roads, for bridges, for rail, airports, regular ports, broadband internet expansion, a whole lot of things that pretty much everybody in both sides of the aisle agree are needed. But when it came time to the final vote, Senator Young flip-flopped and said that he can't possibly support this plan that he helped put together because he says it costs too much money. I did the math. It's 1/3 of 1% of all the money the federal government is going to spend this year. which isn't that much money when you think about it. I mean, it's a lot of money. The unfunded part is $256 billion, but since Todd Young has been representing Indiana in the Senate, the national debt has gone up $8 trillion, and he voted for pretty much all the policies that led to that. So, you know, it's hard to suddenly be concerned about, you know, what amounts to pennies on the dollar that could have a major impact on Indiana. The estimate says it's going to bring $6.6 billion to the state for roads and bridges, plus millions more for other infrastructure projects. So, you know, for a pretty small cost, Indiana could get $7 billion. And Senator Young, Senator Braun said they don't want it.
We're talking with Dan Carton with The Times about the stories he's put out in print and online lately. One story, and I know that you all at The Times and we have at Lakeshore Public Radio have kept an eye on in the years past and up to today, is measures that the General Assembly and our local lawmakers are very supportive of. And your story talks about one that the governor actually signed into law. It wasn't a celebration that was delayed because of the pandemic, but the idea is that he officially put into law, I guess, a bill that was passed by, and sponsored actually, and passed through the legislature by a Northwest Indiana lawmaker that will have a big impact on young people who have to go to hospitals in Chicago.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing concern for a while. Indiana, prior to this legislation, paid very little money to out-of-state children's hospitals for treating Indiana children who get their health coverage through Medicaid. This is mostly an issue in Northwest Indiana because there's several children's hospitals in Chicago that are much, much closer than the Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis. So people from the region have always preferred to go to these Chicago hospitals. The Chicago hospitals were saying, you know, we're happy to treat you, but it's getting to be a problem where the state isn't paying us anything to treat these Medicaid kids. So State Representative Hal Slager and actually quite a few members of the Northwest Indiana delegation worked on this for several years to try and put together a plan where Indiana would start paying more to these out-of-state children's hospitals that treat Hoosier kids who have cancer, born premature, and, you know, all the kinds of things that end up putting a kid in a children's hospital for an extended period of time. And they finally pieced together a plan this year and got it through the General Assembly. And the governor signed it into law in April and then recently had a signing ceremony to get all the advocates together. And he signed the bill again to, you know, give everybody an opportunity to sort of celebrate this accomplishment that Northwest Indiana kids, except in rare circumstances, aren't going to get turned away by Chicago Children's Hospitals. And, you know, the parents aren't going to have to, you know, I mean, if you're treating if a kid's undergoing cancer treatment and if you go to the hospital once a week, I mean, it's so much closer to go to Chicago than it is to go to Indianapolis.
Oh, that's true.
Especially if a parent or family has, you know, other kids and someone's working and, you know, these are Medicaid families, so they're probably low income. So it's really helping. We're going to help a lot of families up here, according to the people who supported the measure.
I'm sure that Representative Slager was very, very happy, very proud when even though he knew the measure passed, and we talked about it on one of our opportunities on Thursdays, not long after the General Assembly ended, that this measure made it through, and it was certainly going to be signed into law. But I'm sure that with this, I guess you could call a revisiting signing ceremony, that still Hal Slager is very happy.
Yeah, this is something he talked about on the campaign trail. He was out of the General Assembly for a couple of years. He lost in 2018. And when he was running in 2020, you know, this was the top issue that he was talking to his constituents about, and it was the first thing he tried to get done once he got back to the State House in 2021. So he seems very happy to get this measure enacted into law.
Dan Carton is the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and as he comes on regionally speaking Thursdays to talk about the pieces that he has put out in print and online. And as always, Dan, thank you, and hope to have you back on again soon. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's talk to Alex Kukulka. She's a reporter for the Post-Tribune about the stories she's covered in print and online this week. Some major stories. First, let's talk about the meeting in Valparaiso that you attended recently. The redistricting meetings have been called by the state, and some citizens that are not happy about where it was being held, but just what they had to say in general about the redistricting map process.
I attended the meeting Friday. It went a half hour over the two-hour limits. There was a ton of information that people shared. You're right that the first major complaint they had was that it was not held in Lake County, which is a much larger county with many voters and residents, which holding it in Porter County, Valparaiso, made it trickier for them to make their way to the meeting. And then their other major complaint was that there were no maps. A lot of residents expressed a desire or that they hoped that there would be maps that they could actually talk about, discuss, give opinion on, but there were no redistricting maps at the meeting, so they were sort of left to make comments that without seeing any substantial mapping.
One of the things I know that was mentioned, the fact there were representatives from the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission. This is the nonpartisan group that was set up here some time ago. In fact, they actually put out a really big report about what they had learned in the efforts that should be made to properly redistrict the state legislative and the congressional districts, for that matter, too. And they had representative from LaPorte there. Tell us what Lee Morris had to say and the concerns that he had a chance to tell the committee from Indianapolis about.
Yeah, so Lee Morris is the Republican member of the commission. The commission has three Republican, three Democrat, and three members that are not with any of the major parties. And he discussed how they took time to talk with residents throughout the state, and they came up with like four findings, if you will, of what residents or voters would like out of redistricting. They wanted competitive races, keep community of interest like a county or a school board together as much as possible, and don't divide up cities or counties either. That was the third point. And then the final point was transparency is what voters wanted. And so he mentioned that the commission was created as sort of like a demonstration project to show that, you know, a group of people from different parties, different walks of life could come together and help the legislature with the redistricting process. So he really encouraged the legislators on the panel to reach out to the commission for any future help with
I understand the state Senator Eddie Melton from Gary was there as well, too, attending the meeting. What did Senator Melton have to say?
Yeah, so he said that as someone who's in the sort of super minority party, he understands how like redistricting really will impact the legislative process. He talked a lot about how, you know, given a super majority right now, it's hard for the minority party to get legislation heard or passed or, you know, even frankly discussed because of the way the super majority is running things right now. So he said that he would hope that the new maps would sort of be fairer to limit the impacts it has at the state house in terms of passing legislation. And then he was also one of the state senators who expressed disappointment with the fact that the meeting was not held in Lake County.
Now we have had these people come in and speak at the one meeting in Valparaiso that you attended. What is the process as far as getting the redistricting maps together and getting the actual changes made? What's the next process or next step, we should say, in the process?
Yeah, so they announced at the start of the meeting, they sort of walked a little bit through the process. So the census data, which is used to make the maps, will be available August 12th. And that's delayed slightly because of the COVID-19 pandemic from when, like, you typically would receive the data. And then the legislature plans to meet in about, like, mid-September to debate and vote on the new districts. And they said that they announced at the panel that voters and residents can draw and submit their own maps through an online portal with a mapping software at all Ivy Tech campuses. And they did make sure to note that the redistricting is handled like a typical piece of legislation so that public comment will still be available at that point to some degree, and it has to pass like a a standard piece of legislation.
We're talking with Alice Kukulka with the Post Tribune about the story she's put out in print and online recently. Another major story, an update of which just came out here in recent days, is dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, in particular what kind of impact this latest problem, the dealing with the Delta variant, is having on Lake County. Will you tell us first about what Dr. Vivilala, the Lake County Health Officer, had to say when she met with the County Council recently?
So she stressed and highlighted that the county's positivity rate, emergency room visits, and hospitalizations are increasing amid this new Delta variant wave. She also, though, stressed that she unfortunately wasn't able to make any recommendations to the council on how to, like, move forward potentially because there was a new state law passed downstate, and it requires that if a health officer wants to impose a stricter mandate than what is currently provided through an executive order during a public health emergency, then the health officer has to get approval from the council. But Tuesday morning, she wasn't able to get a quorum of the Lake County Board of Health. So because she wasn't able to have that quorum and discuss about what recommendations could be, she unfortunately wasn't able to provide it to the council.
Now, did Dr. Vivilala make a mention to the county council, at least, if the county health board agrees with what she might be recommending, no doubt, is there likely to be a change in the procedure where we might have some kind of requirement that here in Lake County, at least, that masks would be required?
So she was asked outright by one of the councilmen if, because in Lake County, county government buildings, the county commissioners would give out a directive if there were to be a potential mask mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was asked outright, like, what recommendation she would give to the commissioners in their thinking about a potential mask mandate. And she said she would recommend to the commissioners to follow CDC guidelines, which right now recommends masks for people regardless of vaccination status.
So the next step, I guess, is for Dr. Vivilala to go before the county health board and give her recommendations, and the county health board will be able to come back with something. And is she then going to be able to bring it back to either the county council or the Lake County commissioners for some kind of action?
Yeah, she stressed that she would do her very best to get a meeting together of the county health board in the coming days, and that she would present something to the council in the coming weeks. She said that deadline wasn't super clear, to be honest, but the council did express, you know, openness to having, like, an emergency meeting if it'd be to vote on their recommendations.
Now, I understand that you got a double byline between you and your colleague Michelle Quinn on one of the stories that's out there in the Post Tribune to take a look at in concerning the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's talking about the impact that this is all having on Northwest Indiana businesses. Will you tell us more about the thoughts that you and Michelle had in talking with the business people and what they had to say about maybe there might be some vaccinations required from employees or masks, or if there isn't already some type of restriction?
Yeah, so given the discussion nationally around, you know, if an employer should mandate vaccination, and there's been a couple companies like Google, Facebook, Walt Disney Company, the National Football League, they've been slowly making rules about, you know, getting a vaccine, or if you're not vaccinated, to wear a mask and undergo testing. So we're really curious how locally local businesses are sort of grappling with this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that, you know, they're obviously aware of the situation of other companies doing this, but also it's this, like, tightrope of wanting to be safe and also, you know, forcing essentially employees to get vaccinated.
What did some of the business people you talked to have to say? You talked to a wide range of people, ranging from restaurateurs to the people that are in charge of the operations at the new casino.
Yeah, so I spoke with Jocelyn Kelly. She's the owner of Jay's Breakfast Club in Gary, and she told us a little bit about how, you know, she is vaccinated, but she doesn't require her 9 employees to do the same, even though she, like, strongly suggested for them, but it's not a requirement to work for her. And she really summarized the complexity of how it's very difficult right now to hire people in the restaurant industry. So she expressed sort of, like, not wanting to turn someone away because they're not vaccinated, but also, or like firing someone who isn't vaccinated, and then making sure, you know, her restaurant is fully staffed. So it's this like catch 22 or like a double-edged sword almost of making sure she has employees, but then making sure they're safe, and then in turn keeping customers safe. So she also expressed how the recent changes in mask requirements and the development of the Delta variant are, you know, she's feeling a little confused and frustrated on that because the rules seem to be changing day to day. So she did express sort of the difficulty there. But then on the other side, like you mentioned, the Hard Rock Casino, they you know, offered COVID-19 vaccinations on site for employees. They, you know, sort of gave incentive by offering $50 gift cards and allowed their employees to enter a raffle for an additional prize. So they had some incentives there, but it does not like require vaccinations at the end of the day, even though they're encouraging it and doing stuff like that. They do not require it.
I understand too that you all had a chance to talk with some major businesses here in Northwest Indiana, in particular with Strack and Van Til's Jeff Strack. What did Jeff have to say about making sure that his employees at all of the stores in Lake and Porter counties are properly covered and their employees are safe?
So at Strack and Van Til, they're also not requiring employees to get vaccinated, but that management is watching like all local, state, and federal guidelines on the developments of the virus. Jeff Strack said that the company will continue reviewing policies as conditions develop and warrant, but that right now they're not requiring vaccination of their employees either.
Well, Alex, thank you for spending time with us to going over these two major stories, talking about the public hearing held in Valparaiso concerning upcoming redistricting work that state lawmakers are going to do in Indianapolis on the state legislative and congressional district maps, and the latest we have involving the Delta variant of coronavirus and how Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular is going to have to deal with that. Thank you for being with us today, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on August 19th is going to be the special tour that people in Northwest Indiana will want to check out. It is called Back to the Future, a mid-century modern home tour, and it's being sponsored through Indiana Landmarks by Indiana Landmarks affinity group called Indiana Modern. And with us to talk about the tour and the fact that there's a local angle to it is Mark DeLossi. He is Vice President for Preservation Services with Indiana Landmarks. And Mark, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Good morning, Chris.
Well, tell us about the idea behind the tour and, in more particular, about all of the homes that are going to be on display, so to speak, coming up here on August 19th and the one that's happening here in Munster.
Well, sure. Well, the idea behind the tour sort of got started because we saw back a number of years ago, we did our first tour in 2007, that there really wasn't much of an appreciation for architecture of the mid-20th century. And so we thought, well, what's a way that we can heighten the appreciation for the design, that period, and yet let people have fun, you know, do it in a way that was entertaining and enjoyable. And so we decided to set out and do these tours. And typically they have been in a single community, five houses that people can either, you know, walk, bike, drive to, et cetera. But this year, because of COVID, we decided to choose five locations from around the state that people could then tune into and watch virtually, almost like a documentary.
Well, that's interesting. I know, at least up here in Northwest Indiana, and probably other places in the state that are recognized as such, that, we have the homes that are now based, of course, that have came across the Lake Michigan from the Chicago World's Fair and are planted, of course, along Lake Michigan, which Indiana Landmarks is very much involved in preservation purposes.
Right.
But there are other houses, yeah, like this one and others around the state that people probably locally recognize as very special houses. And this one in particular, let's talk about the one that is actually that going to be on the display. First up, for that matter, that's on the tour is a house in Munster. Tell us about this house. Who designed it? Who put it up for the family that first that initially lived in it, and who the current owners are now?
Right. So the house was built for the O'Neill family back in 1964, and it was designed by a Chicago area architect by the name of John McPherson, and he, I believe, was based first in on the south side of Chicago and then a little later in Homewood, and but he also did designs for houses in southern Chicago and in places like Flossmoor and
homes around suburban Chicago, yeah.
Yeah, a couple other communities in the immediate surrounding area there. And then, but he did do several in Munster. As a matter of fact, the house immediately to the north of this one he also designed. So it was sort of his specialization or time period that he worked, that he did a number of mid-century modern homes. So the O'Neills lived in it for a number of years, and eventually David and Amy Carter, who are the current owners, found the home and have lived in it ever since. They have two sons they're raising there, and they all really love the place, and it's a really unique property.
What sort of things did John McPherson have in mind when he designed that home initially for the O'Neills, which is now, as you mentioned, owned and occupied by the Carters? Was there any special architecture or design that he had in mind when he came up with that initial design?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because it's a really unique floor plan. The house is basically a cruciform plan, so sort of a cross with doorways on all four ends, and then on the corners it has four sort of square living units, if you will. The garage is one, the kitchen is another, the children's bedroom is another section, and then the parents' bedroom and study is in another. And then within the cruciform is where you have the entry and the living room, dining room, and family room areas. Mm-hmm. So it's a really comfortable house to live in, because everybody kind of gathers or comes together in this area where all four of these pods, if you'll call them that, come together into this common space. So it'll be obviously much clearer when people see the tour.
That's true.
As to exactly what this looks like. The other thing I'll add is that the Carters own a business up there in Northwest Indiana called Pegboard Modern, and you can find that online, but I believe their actual location is in Highland. And they acquire and sell mid-century modern furnishings, everything from furniture to art to sculpture to many, many different pieces from that period. And so their home is furnished with a really outstanding collection of those pieces that people are going to get to see on the tour.
Do you think that maybe that McPherson had in mind some of, maybe he was influenced in large part by some of the European architects that had, modern architects, we should say, that maybe towards the early 20th century came up with ideas very similar to this, this box concept? I'm thinking of designers like Le Corbusier, you know, who has very interesting homes in Europe. Some, I think, are still standing, that have that kind of design. They're laid out like that.
Yes, I'm sure he was very influenced. As a matter of fact, I mean, he was probably even more influenced by some of those architects that practiced in the Chicago area, like Mies van der Rohe, who taught at the Illinois Institute of Technology.
Right.
And, you know, maybe he's not European, but Frank Lloyd Wright, who is, you know, was in Oak Park and then up in Wisconsin. And so I'm sure that the designs that those architects were espousing in that immediate Chicagoland area were things that he picked up on.
We're talking with Mark DeLossi. He is a vice president for preservation services with Indiana Landmarks, and he's also working with the Landmarks affinity group called Indiana Modern for their very popular Back to the Future, a mid-century modern home tour. Usually it's done, in person, but because of the pandemic, it's being done virtually on video this year, and we've been first hearing about this unique 1964-era house in Munster. Are there any other homes within the reach of Northwest Indiana, which everybody, I suppose, you could see by way of video with this tour, that maybe somebody like in Northwest Indiana would be interested in finding out more about?
Yeah, there really aren't any others on the tour in the immediate Northwest Indiana area. Mm-hmm. And again, part of that was by design, that we wanted to feature homes from around the state that might have been logistically difficult to get to, even if we had done a tour in their area. We have houses in Munster, in West Lafayette, in Marion, which is a Frank Lloyd Wright designed home, in Bloomington, and in just outside of New Albany.
Wow.
So it's really kind of from all the way from the north to the south.
Well, sounds interesting. Well, tell us about the tour. You mentioned here earlier on about the fact that you have the tour starting on August 19th, and folks will get to see it by way of video, so this way they get to see these other great houses around the state and basically pretty much all four corners of the state or close to it. How can people be able to get involved in the video tour coming up on August 19th? And if they can't actually be there on the 19th for the actual showings, so to speak, how can they have a chance to check these homes out later?
Definitely. So the tour, as you noted, will premiere on August the 19th, and you do need to purchase a ticket to receive the link to participate in the Zoom webcast. And so the tickets are $15 for Indiana Landmarks members, $20 for members of the general public, so you can watch it that evening at home, get friends together, have a watch party, do whatever you want to, and then we are going to make the tour available for up to 2 weeks afterwards, so if you can use your link to access the tour, if you know you couldn't be there on the 19th to watch it, that you could still partake or watch the tour at a later date.
Now, I understand that it's going to be available, the tickets, that is, will be available on an Eventbrite page. That's midcenturytour21.eventbrite.com. So you can go online right now and get your tickets and have them ready for the tour coming up. And is there more information about the homes that the Indiana Modern has put out that people can check out perhaps on their website so they can look into other interesting homes like that?
Actually, you can also purchase tickets through Indiana Landmarks' website.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to www.indianalandmarks.org, you can find a link to that Eventbrite site there, which might be even easier for folks to remember.
True.
But yes, so you'll be able to purchase tickets through our website.
Well, sounds like an interesting modern home tour that is coming up, getting started with the video format on August 19th, and you get to see homes from around the state, including a very unique house in Munster. Mark DeLossi is the Vice President for Preservation Services with Indiana Landmarks, and he is working very closely with the affinity group called Indiana Modern on this tour. Thank you, Mark, for being with us to talk about this, and hope that the tour goes well, and we'll have to check it out and see what kind of architecture that is in this particular house in Munster.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to our guests, Times of Northwest Indiana reporter Dan Carton, Post Tribune reporter Alex Kukulka, and to Mark DeLossi with Indiana Landmarks. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll be back with you on Monday.